Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 29th of March, these are our main stories. The International Olympic Committee has recommended that athletes from Russia and Belarus should be allowed to take part in international competitions, effectively lifting a ban imposed after Russia invaded Ukraine last year. Hundreds of thousands of people have demonstrated across France again in protest at President Macron's plans to raise the state pension age. Mexico's president has said a fire that killed 39 migrants at a facility close to the United States border was started by the migrants themselves. Also in this podcast, mammoth meatballs, anyone?
The woolly mammoth DNA is actually available on a public database. And so we identified a key gene that we were most interested in.
The scientists on a mission to make meatballs from the long extinct mammoth. There's been a backlash after the International Olympic Committee recommended that athletes from Russia and Belarus be allowed to return to international competition, although only as individuals under a neutral flag. The move essentially lifts the ban imposed in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine. The German government has described it as a slap in the face for Ukrainian athletes. The IOC president, Thomas Bach, speaking at a news conference, explained the conditions attached to those taking part in the contest.
Athletes with a Russian or a Belarusian passport must compete only as individual neutral athletes. Teams of athletes with a Russian or Belarusian passport cannot be considered. Athletes who actively support the war cannot compete.
We got more from our sports news reporter, Alex Capstick.
Well, the IOC said back in February, just after the war began, the invasion of Ukraine, that they would exclude Russians and Belarusians, they said, for safety reasons and to protect the integrity of the competition. And they said that what's changed since then is that despite this recommendation, lots of sports have welcomed Russians and Belarusians. They've been competing as neutrals in sports like tennis, in cycling, in handball, and it's all gone well. The other reason they said they've changed their mind on this is because they've taken advice from United Nations experts who said that if they did ban people based on their passport, then they would be breaching their human rights. So that's why they've come up with these new rules, these new regulations that they're recommending. It's not an order, it's a recommendation. The final decision will go to the individual sports federations, but it's a list of rules which will allow Belarusians and Russians to compete as independent, neutral athletes.
But some people are very unhappy about this.
Yes, it won't please everyone. Ukraine have threatened to boycott on this in the past if Russians and Belarusians are allowed to compete at the Olympic Games next year in Paris. There was no decision on that today. Thomas Bach said that will be made at an appropriate time, but he didn't say exactly when that would be. They're going to see how this current system, or the system they've unveiled today, works out over the next weeks and months. But yes, there has been some strong reaction. A group of around 300 former and current international fencers wrote to Thomas Bach demanding that their own federation row back on its decision to allow Russians and Belarusians to compete. Germany's elite athletes group, Athletin Deutschland, it called for a complete ban whilst the war continued in Ukraine. And recently in the World Boxing Championships, the Women's World Boxing Championships, a dozen countries did actually boycott that because of Russian and Belarusian involvement in that event. As Polish minister in the government there, he said it was a slap in the face to Ukraine from the IOC today in this decision.
Alex Capstick. A fire that claimed dozens of lives at an immigration centre in Mexico close to the US border may have been started by the migrants themselves. The Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said the men being held there set their mattresses on fire in protest as they feared they were about to be deported.
Como protesta en la puerta del albergue, They put mattresses in the door of the shelter and set them on fire as a protest and did not imagine that it would cause this terrible tragedy. What we know so far is that it was mainly migrants from Central America and some from Venezuela who were in the shelter.
Images show rows of bodies lying under shimmering silvery sheets outside the burnt-out building as frantic relatives bang on the windows of emergency vehicles transporting the injured to hospital. 39 men died. Another 29 were injured. This Venezuelan woman told reporters she was desperate for information about her husband, who was one of those being detained at the centre in Ciudad Juárez.
I am human too, but they treat you like a dog. He was taken away in an ambulance. They haven't told me anything. A relative could have died and they wouldn't tell you. Is he dead? Nothing.
Our correspondent in Mexico City, Marcos González, gave us this update.
We know that the fire started around 10 p.m. Local time here in Mexico at the center run by the Mexico's National Migration Institute, which is located very close to the bridge that links Ciudad Juárez with El Paso in the United States. According to Mexican President, as we know, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the fire started during a protest as they were told that they would be deported to their countries. So they set alight to some mattresses, and it seems this is what spread the fire very quickly. Authorities are investigating now why they couldn't leave the building on time, in which conditions they were in the center, and related to the victims, we still don't know their identities, but we know most of them were from Central America, mainly from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and also from Venezuela. Also, according to some local media, some of them had been detained by authorities on Monday and taken to the center after they found them in the city of Ciudad Juárez without the right documentation to stay here in Mexico.
And these were all men, and clearly very desperate to have resorted to such an extreme step in order to try to highlight their plight.
Absolutely. As we probably know, Ciudad Juárez, well, as many other Mexican cities in the northern border, has seen an increase of migrants coming from other countries trying to cross to the U.S. So all of them are awaiting there, close to the border, a possible lifting of restrictions, which at the moment did not happen. So some of them stay here for days, for weeks, or even for months. So, what happens is, as you can see in the image, is really awful. The image were terrible. So, of course, relative of people of the victims are really angry, are asking for an explanation about what happened and which is the explanation, the official explanation from the government about why they couldn't escape from the building on time to save their lives.
Marcos González. Hundreds of thousands of protesters have marched through Paris and other French cities on a 10th day of strikes and rallies against the government's pension reforms. Demonstrations were mostly peaceful, but there were some clashes with police, with dozens arrested. Protesters are angry after legislation to raise the retirement age in France from 62 to 64 was forced through by President Emmanuel Macron's government using a special constitutional power. Lucy Williamson watched events unfold in Paris.
Numbers may be lower, but the tension around these protests has spiralled. Police and protesters both came braced for violence today, each from the other. Almost 900 officers have been injured during these demonstrations so far. The government has blamed extreme left groups and put 13,000 security forces on the streets to police today's marches. But Loic Valda, spokesman for the UNSA police union, says some bystanders are also joining in attacks on the police.
I think after the COVID, after everything that happened to France, the inflation and everything, people start to be really tense. And that doesn't help to reduce the violence against the police, because the police is representing the state. It can also explain why we have more and more police officers hurt.
But public anger has also been inflamed over the past week by several video and audio recordings, apparently showing officers from a rapid reaction unit threatening and attacking demonstrators who posed no threat. Among them, Salomé Rio, who is now suing the police.
It's important to have policemen that are able to protect people. But in that case, they were not protecting us. We must have been protected from them. That is really worrying to me.
The Paris police chief has described the rapid reaction force, known as Brave M, as indispensable in policing the protests, despite a series of allegations of violence and racist abuse now being investigated by the Paris prosecutor and the Inspectorate of Police. Meanwhile, on the streets, anger at the government is merging with anger at the police.
Our Paris correspondent, Lucy Williamson. Myanmar's military rulers have announced that Aung San Suu Kyi's political party, the National League for Democracy, has been dissolved. Here's our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
The National League for Democracy won two landslide election victories in Myanmar before being ousted from power in a coup by the army 2 years ago. It was automatically dissolved after declining to re-register as a political party before a deadline on Tuesday. The NLD refuses to take part in a political process that it says is designed to keep the military in power after any future election, and one that's led to its leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, being jailed for more than 30 years.
Michael Bristow. A court in Russia has sentenced a man whose daughter drew an anti-war picture at school to 2 years in jail. They've been separated for weeks as she was put into a children's home and he was placed under house arrest. Now, Alexei Muskeliov has been found guilty of discrediting the army. His trial began on Monday and ended on Tuesday with an unexpected twist. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, explains.
The judge came into the courtroom to deliver the verdict. The prosecutor came into the courtroom, but there was no defendant. The judge read out the verdict, guilty, and the sentence, 2 years in prison. Case over. Then the court spokesperson revealed that Alexei Muskeliov had disappeared. He'd gone on the run, she said, during the night. So a bizarre end to this case. It began last year, this whole story, when Alexei's daughter, she was 12 at the time, Masha, had drawn an anti-war picture at school, showing a Ukrainian flag and the words "Glory to Ukraine" and a Russian flag and the words "No to War." And she also drew Russian missiles coming towards Ukraine and a Ukrainian mother and a child standing defiantly in their path. Alexei at the time said that after that picture, the school called the police, and then problems began for him. He said that police began checking his social media. And since that picture appeared, he was charged twice, in two separate occasions, with discrediting the Russian armed forces and for criticising the war in Ukraine.
What's happened to his daughter, Masha?
At the beginning of March, when Alexei was arrested and put under house arrest before the trial, at the same time, his daughter Masha was taken to a local children's home. And the local social services in the town of Yefremov, the Juvenile Affairs Commission, began legal action to restrict his parental rights. And there was supposed to be a case about that going on and another hearing in a few days' time. But now that Alexei has been found guilty and given this 2-year sentence, the judge also ruled that local social services now will officially be charged with looking after Masha.
Has Alexei had much support?
It's an interesting question. When I was in the town a few days ago, I met some local activists who were very vocal in their support for Alexei, people who believed that this case highlighted the cracking down on dissent, the cracking down on freedom of speech across Russia. There have been many cases of this. People who went shopping for him, bought him food and water and supplies because he was under house arrest. He was banned from communicating with most people, only with his lawyer and the investigator. But when I spoke to his neighbours, when I spoke to other people around town, I sensed a lot of people were kind of frightened to express their opinion. In fact, some people came out and said, you know, we don't want to speak to you about this. We are scared. So I think that reflects the sort of the level of fear now in Russian society. You know, more than a year after the invasion of Ukraine, there is a feeling that speaking out and speaking your opinion can land you in trouble.
Steve Rosenberg speaking to my colleague Julian Marshall. Have you ever fancied trying a mammoth burger? No, not a huge burger, but one made from the giant woolly prehistoric creature that was hunted to extinction thousands of years ago. Well, if you've ever wondered what mammoth and chips would taste like, you could be in luck, as scientists have been working with a firm in Australia to make mammoth meatballs in their labs. James Ryle is a chief scientific officer of the cultivated meat company Vow.
The woolly mammoth DNA is actually available on a public database. And so we identified a key gene that we were most interested in. And that gene is called myoglobin. And myoglobin was of interest to us because it's typically thought to be responsible for the aroma and the colour of meat.
With more, here's Beth Timmins.
On top of spaghetti, all covered with cheese, I lost my poor meatball.
Sadly, I'm yet to taste a woolly mammoth meatball, but I can tell you it's been made by making the DNA sequence for a muscle protein from a long-extinct mammoth, which scientists say gives the synthetic substance its meaty flavour. The scientists, based at the Australian Institute for Bioengineering at the University of Queensland, then used elephant DNA to bolster the gaps left in the mammoth sequence and grew the meat from a sheep's stem cells. If you're lost, just imagine taking cuttings from a plant and growing them in a greenhouse. In the same way, cells are taken from the animal, given the vitamins, nutrients and minerals they would get in the animal, and then the cells are grown to make the meat. In just a couple of weeks, 20 billion cells were used by the company to grow the mammoth meat, which hasn't been tasted in around 4,000 years. The firm, Vow, said it chose the woolly mammoth because it's a symbol of environmental loss. It's all part of a growing movement to make more sustainable meat. While plant-made alternatives are now common, meat grown from stem cells in a lab, without animal slaughter, is creating many kinds of replacements for the sheep, pig, chicken and cow meat, usually made in large-scale production farms. If made at scale, lab-grown meat could cut the climate impact of farm meat by up to 92%, reduce air pollution by up to 94%, and use 90% less land, according to a recently peer-reviewed journal article. Saren Kell at the Good Food Institute Europe told me what she thought of the project.
Scientifically, it's definitely a fascinating project, and we hope that it does draw attention to what cultivated meat can do and its extraordinary potential to produce protein far more sustainably. But as the most common sources of meat are farm animals, most of the sustainable protein sector is more focused on actually realistically replicating meat from these species. That's where you can have the most impact in terms of reducing emissions from conventional animal agriculture.
Vow is not the first firm to try to make lab-grown meat from an extinct animal. In 2018, another made gummy bear sweets out of gelatin created from the DNA of a mastodon, a relative of the mammoth. Others are looking into cultured meat from buffalo, peacock and crocodile, if that whets your appetite.
Beth Timmins. Still to come.
He said, oh, do you think there's $10,000 worth in it? And as soon as it hit my hand, I looked at him and I said, try $100,000. He said, oh, but that's only half the rock. He said, the other half's at home.
The detectorist in Australia who struck gold.
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season two.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
To the US now and the aftermath of yet another school shooting which has left three adults and three children dead. Police in Nashville say the suspect had legally purchased seven firearms. They've released footage that shows how officers managed to kill the shooter minutes after they arrived at the school. Police say the assailant, Audrey Hale, was a biological woman who used male pronouns. The chief of police in Nashville, John Drake, said the parents of the shooter felt the 28-year-old should not own weapons.
We know that they felt that she had one weapon and that she sold it. She was under care, doctor's care, for an emotional disorder. Law enforcement knew nothing about the treatment she was receiving, but her parents felt that she should not own weapons. They were under the impression that was when she sold the one weapon that she did not own anymore.
Our correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, spoke to us from the scene of the shooting.
Footage shows the 28-year-old arriving at the school in a car, shooting through glass doors to get in and then roaming the hallways with a rifle. Minutes later, two officers, Michael Colazzo and Rex Engelbert, enter the building.
Let's go! I need three!
One more!
After a room-to-room search of the ground floor, the officers hear gunfire upstairs and head to intercept.
Shots fired, move!
As he rounds the corner, one of the officers spots the attacker and takes
a
shot.
Right.
As the police piece together what happened, the focus has once again turned to the politics of guns in America and who has the right to access them. President Biden has called once again for Congress to ban assault rifles, the type used in this shooting. He and lawmakers from both sides passed major gun safety legislation last year, but many Republicans say a ban would be a step too far.
Noumia Iqbal. Now, the story of a remarkable woman. Emohoi Segwe Mariam Gebru was a prominent Ethiopian musician and nun. She's died in Jerusalem at the age of 99. She'd been living at the Ethiopian monastery there for the past four decades and had donated the proceeds raised from her music to help people in need. As a child, she was a prisoner of war. Then she went on to study music in Cairo, where her talent was discovered. She'd wanted to study in London, but when she couldn't go, she turned to religion. Emohoi herself told a BBC documentary that she would have preferred to keep a low profile, but that God had had other plans.
I didn't want to be famous, really. I asked also God that my name be written on heaven, not on earth. But he wanted not to lose the music. It's only by the grace of God.
Hannah Kebede is Emohoi's niece, and she's co-founder of the Emohoi Segwe Mariam Music Foundation. Speaking to my colleague Razia Iqbal from Jerusalem, she related her early memories of her aunt.
Becoming a nun meant that she was to kind of walk away from earthly desires, and she had such a strong passion for her music, and I always kind of sympathized and empathized with her on that.
And she was fluent in many languages, in seven languages, and was a feminist and had so many things about her. I wonder if you could help us try and understand the kind of music that she then went on to make, because she did return to music after spending time in this monastery in northern Ethiopia, living barefoot. But she changed the kind of music that she was both composing and playing.
I would say that her religious music is probably inspired by Saint Yared's music, and then there is her other compositions, which, you know, talk about the wind or the sea, or some that she composed about different members of her family, some that she composed after the Italian occupation or for the famine disaster and so on. I think she made a lot of her own attempts to publish her music. She was published long before her Ethiopic 21 CD, which made her famous in the world, was released. She had self-published in Germany in the 70s, her albums, although, of course, in very small numbers. But all that is a testament to the fact that she wanted to make sure that her music got out to the world.
Hannah Kebede talking about the Ethiopian musician and nun Emohoi Segwe Mariam Gebru, who has died at the age of 99. The pandemic made working from home, or WFH as it became known, very popular. Now we could be about to see WFC, or working from a cruise ship. You can now book to spend 3 years living on a cruise ship, including office facilities to allow you to get on with your professional life if you can afford it. The cruise ship will be departing from Istanbul on November the 1st. My colleague Evan Davis found out more from Alex Starr, a digital nomad who's worked around the world for years, and Mike Pettersson, the managing director of the company behind the vessel.
It starts about $100,000 per person for the 3 years. We include Wi-Fi, we include food. We do serve alcohol with dinner, but...
Not yeah. unlimited drinks yeah. for those exactly. prices. Mike, stay there. I want to bring in Alex Starr, who is someone who can identify as a digital nomad, has been for 7 years, has travelled all around the world working. I don't know, Alex, have you spent much time on cruise ships in your nomadry?
Yeah, I have indeed. I mean, I've lived on a cruise ship, I worked on a cruise ship, but I have also run my business from a cruise ship. It's an exciting prospect being able to do that for 3 years.
Is there a tax implication for you, Alex, if you're working from the ship? Because you're not resident in any in any country. Is that part of the appeal?
Certainly, although I do pay full UK tax.
What would be the issue for you? I mean, if we've got Mike Pettersson there selling his cruise to you, what is it that he has to provide that makes it work for you? What facilities?
The first thing is the Wi-Fi. Ultimately, my business fully runs through the internet. So any issue with the internet is a huge problem for me. And cruise ships in the past have been renowned for their pretty lousy internet.
Well, Mike, how good is the Wi-Fi on your ship?
We actually will have Starlink, which is the most reliable internet at sea. Starlink is sending up a satellite every couple of weeks.
Yeah, this is the Elon Musk service, in fact, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So,
Mike, what facilities, what office facilities do you have?
We created a whole big office area with 14 offices, a couple of conference rooms, a business lounge, and a whole copy printing center where people can really just go in, perform their work. And
I mean, Alex, you still can't get a meeting with your clients, can you, if you're on a ship somewhere in the...
No, you can't. And I'm lucky my entire business is remote, so I can work from anywhere in the world. But one of my issues is the time zone, because I have meetings and live meetings, and a lot of my work is
it's a lifestyle of which I'm sure many will dream and a few can make work. Mike Pettersson from Life at Sea Cruises and Alex Starr, thank you both very much.
And they were talking there to Evan Davis. An Australian man out metal detecting in the state of Victoria has made a once-in-a-lifetime discovery. Rachel Wright picks up the story.
The male detectorist, who wishes to remain anonymous, was using the cheapest of metal detectors whilst out looking for gold in the hills of Victoria. He found a rock, put it in his backpack, and headed off to the town of Geelong, about an hour's drive from the state capital Melbourne. The man handed the rock to Darren Camp, the owner of a metal detecting store called Lucky Strike Gold Prospecting. At 4.6 kilograms, Darren says the rock was the biggest he'd ever seen, and he's been in the business for 43 years.
He said, "Oh, do you think there's $10,000 worth in it?" And as soon as it hit my hand, I looked at him and I said, "Try $100,000. He said, "Oh, but that's only half the rock." He said, "The other half's at home."
Darren bought the rock from the man for $240,000, which is around $160,000. He said the man told him his wife would be very happy. The rock was discovered in what is known as Victoria's Golden Triangle area, which had been at the heart of Australia's gold rush in the 1800s. While discoveries like this large rock are rare, Australia is estimated to have the world's largest gold reserves, and many of the world's biggest nuggets have been found there.
Rachel Wright. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Alison Davies. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
A series of increasingly sophisticated cybercrimes being carefully orchestrated around the world.
The attraction to target ATMs is fairly obvious. I mean, they're full of cash.
It was just like abracadabra. Put these cards, put any PIN number, and you get money.
Jackpot.
US investigators say the heists are being carried out by the Lazarus Group, a criminal hacking gang who are said to be working under the orders of the North Korean state.
Tens of millions of dollars for the North Koreans.
These actors are not as anonymous as they think they are.
The group's goal?
to steal money to help fund the country's growing ballistic missile and nuclear program.
But despite evidence suggesting otherwise, North Korea denies any involvement.
In season two of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service, we're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
And piles of stolen cash.
Over $2 billion. We're at $2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.